All right, everybody needs to be in their places so she doesn't have that need.
I call together the House Committee on Human Services today, February 20th, 2009, and I will open up the informational hearing to the Psychiatric Review Board Siting Work Group. And we will have the first panel will be Joe O'Leary, Judge Daryl Larson, Benton County Commissioner Jay Dixon, and to Wolfson Police Chief Kent Barker. Oh, and Ashley. Can we all fit up there? Thank you all for coming, and I think you're going to have to send your mics around so that everybody can share. And as most of you know, please announce who you are before you start speaking, and I'll let whomever starts start.
Thank you, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Joe O'Leary. For the record, I am Governor Kulongoski's public safety advisor. It's an honor to be here today to introduce this panel who are going to present to you the report and recommendations of the Governor's Psychiatric Security Review Board Siting Work Group. This was a work group that actually, in some respects, had an impetus Chair Tomei, in your committee, your interim committee, and a dialogue that happened December of 2007. It was the House Health and Women's Wellness Interim Committee, and you and some of the members of that committee heard testimony from members of law enforcement and the Department of Human Services and the Psychiatric Security Review Board about some concerns around the community process by which individuals who are within the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board are conditionally released from the state hospital and placed in, some of which are placed in residential treatment communities throughout Oregon. At the time, myself as the governor's public safety advisor and Aaron Kelly Seal, who was at the time the governor's human services advisors, were watching that testimony carefully. And at about that same time, our individual or respective constituents, mine in the law enforcement community and Aaron's in the mental health treatment and advocacy community, were also filtering up some of these same concerns that you heard or that some of you heard in that hearing back in December of 2007. They were largely questions around the process, questions around what information could be released about individuals in the PSRB jurisdiction and to who, and what the right role of the community is in the siting process. Those conversations prompted Aaron and I to speak with the governor and ultimately get together with our respective stakeholder groups, mine in law enforcement, Aaron's in mental health, and eventually several legislators as well. And there was a kind of a piece of low-hanging fruit that we took care of early on that had to do with the notice that the Psychiatric Security Review Board provides when the decision is made after four levels of review to release an individual from in the PSRB's jurisdiction from the state hospital to the community. And that decision was by the PSRB. They developed a new notice policy that has been implemented by which they are now providing written notice of conditional releases to the law enforcement community in the receiving county to ensure that the local sheriff and police chief, where applicable, are aware that someone in the PSRB's jurisdiction is coming to their community to be placed in a secure or residential treatment facility. There were a lot of other issues, though, that came up about the process, about the siting process, about community notification, and we knew just from our cursory discussions that there were some landmines. Some of those landmines had to do with federal law and the federal law overlays. Some of them had to do with state law, and some of them just had to do with the lack of understanding of the process of the of this really sometimes rough, if you will, interface between the criminal justice system and the mental health system in this state. So it became pretty clear that a greater dialogue needed to happen, and the governor directed Aaron and I to convene this work group that began to meet in April of 2008 and concluded its work just recently and completed the report that is going to be submitted to you today. What I want to tell you about the work group itself and the development, Judge Larson is going to talk about the recommendations here in a moment, but I've already mentioned to you these are complicated, very complicated issues. There is complicated federal and state law overlays. There are emotional and visceral issues from the various stakeholders on both sides. And there are a diversity of lenses through which this issue is viewed. There's a diversity of the fund of knowledge. Even the different people that came to the table, myself included, who we all, I think, thought we knew a lot about the process, and we, myself included, learned a lot more. So there was a tremendous potential for conflict, and I mean that in a bad way, in this work group. There was a tremendous potential for wheel spinning, but we set out to create an agenda that was informative, open, a panel, if you will, of members that was inclusive, and a methodology around going at this issue that ensured that everyone came up to the same fund of knowledge, the same level of knowledge about the various issues that touch this citing topic. And I think our first choice was actually part of the success, and that was to choose a facilitator who's seated to my left, Judge Daryl Larson, now retired from the Lane County Circuit Court, a former drug court judge, a former prosecutor, longtime prosecutor in Lane County, and the chair of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. We made a good choice in asking Judge Larson to facilitate this group, and I think we made a lot of progress. And I'm going to turn it over to Judge Larson, unless there are any questions, which I'm happy to answer.
Thank you, Joe. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for clarification, are we discussing?
We're not discussing legislation, Madam Chair.
Well, are we talking about the siting of a facility or the placement of residents within the facility or both?
Good question, Chair Tomei, Representative Huffman. The scope of the work group, which Judge Larson is going to speak to specifically, though, was to identify the roles and functions of the various players in the process of siting these community facilities that serve individuals within the PSRB's jurisdiction. So the focus really was on the siting process itself. Now, that said, to get to that conversation, the work group had many informational presentations that really started with the basics. We started out talking about the criminal justice system and criminal responsibility under Oregon law. Who gets convicted of a crime? Who is adjudicated guilty except for insanity? What are the standards by which they are? What happens when a person is placed in the jurisdiction of the PSRB? What are the decisions a judge has to make? Once a person is placed in the PSRB, how does the PSRB supervise that person? Are they placed in the state hospital or not, and why? Once they're in the state hospital, what happens to that person while they are there? What is the process then by which initially medical staff at the hospital make a recommendation to the PSRB to consider conditional release? And then this, as I said, that's the first step of this four-step process that ultimately results, if the board chooses, to conditional release a person. And then the board goes through a process with the community provider to determine the best placement. So we discussed quite, I think, pretty exhaustively for the fact that we had a group of volunteers, all of those issues. We ultimately did not make any recommendations in this report about the fundamental process by which individuals are found guilty except for insanity and conditional release. There were, though, some pieces around the edges that I think Judge Larson will tell you about.
Okay, thank you.
And colleagues, we should have, did everybody get this? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay, good. And I think there's even a longer a document that we can access by email.
I had read some of the information for today, and it seemed to me that it was going to be discussing the siting of a home. But then we were talking about the placement of individuals within in the home. So I just wanted to know the scope of what we were going to discuss.
Thank you. Judge Larson, thank you so much for coming today, and thank you so much for the role that you played in this work
thank
group.
Thank you. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present these recommendations to you this morning. The members of the work group came together in a spirit of cooperation with a genuine willingness to learn more about the people with mental illness and the public safety concerns of Oregon's communities. There was a great deal of common ground about the need to provide more public education about these issues. There were many lively discussions, and some were very lively, that included a wide variety of perspectives, as was mentioned by Joe. Ultimately, the work group fulfilled its mission to provide guidance as Oregon moves toward building a modern and mental health system. As facilitator, I challenged all the participants to find common ground and to reach consensus on as many issues and recommendations as possible. I am pleased to say that this effort was successful on many issues and many of the concerns that were raised, including some of those mentioned by Joe O'Leary. I would like to briefly cover the membership overview recommendations and the meet and confer bill, HB 2052. The membership of the work group covered the width and breadth of the stakeholders on issues surrounding mental health care and the siting of facilities. There were representatives from the following interest groups: local and county government, Sheriff's Association, Police Chiefs Association, the District Attorney's Association, Mental Health Treatment Providers, County Mental Health Providers Association, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, NAMI of Oregon, Recovery Centers, Oregon Advocacy Center, Consumers of Mental Health Services, Victims Representatives, Psychiatric Security Review Board, and four Oregon legislators, including the chair. Thankfully, we were assisted by very talented members of the governor's office. As mentioned by Joe, they included Joe himself, Erin Kelly Seal before her departure for other duties, and Andy Smith, among a number of others. Our overarching goals and mission included enhancing mutual understanding of Oregon's system for managing persons placed under the jurisdiction of the PSRB, and reaching consensus on ways to strengthen the system consistent with public safety, effective and humane treatment of the mentally ill, and with a realistic eye toward budget considerations, which, as you all know right now, unlike when we started this process, are even more or even higher up on our list of concerns. Our charge was to clarify the process used for siting community-based PSRB secure facilities during the next decade, clarify the roles and functions of state government entities, local government entities, and contractors, to determine whether changes are necessary to strengthen the process, to develop principles and guidelines for involving affected persons, interests, and communities, to clarify when and how federal and state fair housing and non-discrimination laws require restrictions on certain types of project development and information about individuals within the jurisdiction of the PSRB, to recommend effective methods for assuring neighborhoods and consumers that community integrity and safety will not be diminished, and demonstrate how this process will fit into the state's 10-year plan for developing the community resources necessary to support the two replacement facilities of the Oregon State Hospital. It was and is recognized by all that Oregon's system must be transparent, effective, cost-efficient, safe, and provide a factual basis for the public and consumer confidence in the system. It is with that preface that I summarize the work group's recommendations. I present them in no particular order of relative significance. Each is important in its own right. First of all, with respect to communication and collaboration, it was recommended there were a number of recommendations on a number of issues, and to help address the issue of local communities not made part of the facility siting process, it is recommended that best practices be identified and implemented for public involvement. These practices must ensure that there is a clear understanding about the role and jurisdiction of the PSRB and improve transparency in order to provide better information for all stakeholders to participate more fully in the current PSRB system, including timely notice to ensure opportunity for timely participation, and Joe has mentioned one of those this morning. One very important budget impact item would be to provide PSRB with some resources to conduct a formal outreach and education program. I think that that will be touched on in a number of places in my talk this morning, but I don't see that as a big-ticket item at all, but certainly they're stretched pretty thin in terms of the resources they have now. And to accomplish some of these things, it takes a little bit of money, not a lot. It is recommended that we mandate that local communities engage in pre-planning to identify areas and structures in their areas that they believe would be most appropriate for siting of PSRB facilities. One of our recommendations is a meet and confer requirement such as HB 2052, the bill before you today. This would ensure that local government leadership has notice and an opportunity to provide input, coordination, and transparency before DHS develops a secure residential treatment facility. It is recommended that a single DHS PSRB information resource be created to provide real-time information to all stakeholders and the public on current and new developments about siting efforts. It is also recommended that we ensure that facilities have a practice of open, ongoing conversations with law enforcement and reporting protocols for on-site offenses. Policies and practices should be in place to encourage employees or administrators to utilize law enforcement to protect residents and staff. To that end, DHS, in consultation with the PSRB, should adopt statewide protocols for how providers and law enforcement officials partner and cooperate in reporting and investigating alleged crimes that occur at secure residential treatment facilities and in detaining residents of secure facilities who are outside of the facility without authorization. It is recommended that DHS lead and participate in an effort to adopt routine statewide joint training programs for law enforcement officials, district attorneys, consumers, that is, those individuals who have been under the PSRB jurisdiction, providers, victim representatives, city and county representatives, and PSRB staff to promote mutual understanding of the community mental health treatment system. Topics should include but not be limited to notice provisions of existing law, authority and best practices for detention of individuals who unlawfully leave or fail to return to a secure treatment facility, protocols for reporting and investigating alleged crimes at SRTFs, circumstances when law enforcement officials can and should enter facilities, and federal and state fair housing laws and the Americans with Disabilities Act. With respect to victims' rights, to help ensure that crime victims' rights are protected, victims should have a meaningful role in the criminal justice system, be treated with due dignity and respect, and reasonably protected from their offender. To that end, it is recommended that there be created a PSRB victim liaison position within PSRB. It is also recommended that we allow or encourage victims to participate in hearings without being physically present, that is, through written statements or teleconferencing. PSRB policies should specify that victims are welcome to bring along advocates or other support people if they choose to attend hearings. It's also recommended that in cases where an SRTF resident absconds, that consistent policies be developed regarding notifications to victims. Policy should be guided by reasonable safety of the victim and respect for the victim. It is recommended that the PSRB investigate the use of VINE, Victim Notification and Information Every Day, entry for all individuals under PSRB jurisdiction who are placed in an SRTF. It's also recommended that Oregon develop a policy so that victims' regular residence, work, educational, treatment, and locations are considered when an SRTF residence plan for day pass is made. Victims should be encouraged to inform the PSRB about their schedules as part of a conditional release process. Victims should be informed about conditional release plans of a secure treatment facility resident to the extent that the plans may allow for residents and victims to meet each other at victim's regular residence or work, educational, and treatment locations. With respect to standards, operations, and quality, there were a number of things discussed and considered. There is a need to recognize that many recommendations of the PSRB siting work group will require sustained agency leadership and, in some cases, additional financial resources. It does appear, however, that about 20 of the recommendations are already being worked on or can be implemented. It is recommended that the State of Oregon provide the funding necessary for the safe and effective operation of SRTFs to include facility security issues, staff training, and other issues in this report. It is also recommended that the PSRB and DHS should be encouraged to formalize a working relationship, roles and responsibility, data sharing efforts, and staff coordination in the form of a written agreement. With respect to distribution of facilities, because there is a lack of common understanding about the current siting practices, trends, and data, it is recommended that the DHS and PSRB provide current data as a baseline from which to make long-term plans about what is equitable for communities across the state. It's also recommended that in the future, DHS and the PSRB track placement data on a real-time basis for all individuals in the state and track the number and type of placements by county to assist in equitable distribution. In order to clarify equitable distribution expectations, it's also recommended that a model be developed which could be shared with the legislature to ensure equitable, fair distribution of community facilities throughout the state. There's more about that in Appendix C of the report. There are several other recommendations concerning how best to manage the growing need for community placements. It's suggested that residential treatment facilities need to be available in a variety of locations so that someone's need for placement can be reasonably balanced with the need to honor crime victims' rights to safety and respect. The need for more comprehensive planning efforts does require the dedication of more resources within DHS and AMH to create short, medium, and long-term plans for siting of residential treatment facilities. To help address the perceived and or real negative impact on property values in the vicinity of a newly sited residential treatment facility, it's recommended that procedures be instituted to have a neutral party summarize currently existing data and studies on actual impacts of property values. There is paradoxically some information and research that suggests that the thought of decreased property values far exceeds the actual decrease in values. And I guess that's a thankful result, perhaps. With respect to education, the general public is very under and ill-informed about mental illness generally and about the PSRB system in particular. To help remedy this, it is recommended that AMH and the PSRB cooperate in the production of a communication plan, tools, and brochure to explain the history, workings, and track record of the PSRB system, which is actually very, very good. It is also recommended that the relevant Oregon agencies support the efforts of NAMI, the Mental Health of America, and other consumer and family organizations to help address issues of stigma and common misperceptions people have about individuals with mental illness. It is also suggested that the PSRBs provide a greater degree of education for communities regarding access of the PSRB and importance of residential services. It's also recommended that the PSRB and DHS routinely compile credible, timely, and complete data about the mental health and PSRB systems to share with the public and stakeholders. And I want to emphasize that it's both the public and stakeholders who need this information. This should also include the development of an FAQ of siting development issues and include data about the current system and plans for the future. There should be a short, high-level summary of the history of the PSRB system in Oregon. And because it was felt that key stakeholders, much like the public, lack full understanding about the history, functioning, and facts of the PSRB system, similar educational and informational approaches should target the stakeholders. And I don't want to double up in terms of going over what they are, but many of the same ones would apply to both groups. It is also recommended, however, that the PSRB and DHS make educational outreach efforts to local public safety coordinating councils across the state to raise the level of understanding about the PSRB system. These efforts should include development of an FAQ for local municipal governments and law enforcement agencies, including fair housing and ADA case law, concerning which there is considerable misunderstanding. With respect to licensing requirements, some of Oregon's administrative rules need to be amended to clearly define the meaning of a variety of issues relating to SRTFs. These should include amendments to clarify state and the exact definition of a secure facility, detail specifications regarding the physical and structural requirements of secure facilities, establish minimum training and credential minimums for staff, establish minimum qualifications of providers and outside vendors, establish more detailed requirements for the kinds and experience and competency of providers that they must show before operating an SRTF, establish supervision and operational staffing requirements, and establish inspection provisions. I've given staff a copy of my remarks this morning. I have not included within each of those major categories whether they require resources or law changes, either through administrative rule or statutory, but those are noted under each main paragraph within the text of my written comments, and you might want to refer to those. I think one of the things that's developed sort of since we're trying to polish off the final report is that many of these actually can be accomplished without the addition of financial resources, and I think that's a credit to the PSRB, Mary Claire Buckley, and people in AMH and DHS being willing to work together and use the resources they've already got to really take action on many of these recommended items. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Judge Larson. Any quick questions of Judge Larson before we proceed with the others in the panel? As he spoke, I'm not sure how many minutes that was. It summarizes what took many, many, many hours, lots of conflicting views, lots of emotional content in all of these areas, and to think that we came out with this document is nothing short of miraculous. It is, and a lot of it is due to Judge Larson's very level-headed and competent dealing with different factions who have so many different feelings and viewpoints on these issues. So, I want to thank you for all that your work you did on this issue.
Thank you for being such an active participant in this process too. I think I've been on a number of other groups to try to take on problems, and it's extremely helpful to have legislators who are members of those bodies to be really consistently actively involved. I think it gives us some guidance, some reality testing, and really lends to a really good product at the end. So I want to thank you personally.
You're welcome. Madam Chair. Welcome, Representative.
Madam Chair.
Okay, yes.
If I could make just a brief comment. I thank you for your presentation. It was a great overview. And what I really think is interesting for us to comprehend as you come out of this, how little statutory change you see a need for. You know, we so quickly jump to legislative action around every issue that comes up. I appreciate the thoughtful work that went into this to see that there's not a lot of statutory change necessary out there. A great deal more communication and education and a whole variety of things, but that really impressed me in this report. Thank you, Madam Chair.
It did me too, and I think we were very pleased at that because people did work together collaboratively, you know, we were able to come up with some agreements about how we could make changes across the board and not have to come back for legislation. Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Is that okay?
Okay.
although I should probably take priority today, but...
Yeah, that's right.
I didn't get priority yesterday, Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. The composition of the group, I'm obviously this is water under the bridge, but the crime victim side of this, I mean, you talked about recommendations around the crime victims, but there was only one person of the 20 or so that was a crime victim. Were organizations outside of this group consulted on any of this?
Sure. No, Andy.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, thank you for that question. This is Joe O'Leary for the record. The way that Aaron and I went about inviting members of the work group was to ask the relevant organizations to nominate someone to sit at the table. With respect to the crime victim advocate, Representative Carol Schrader, she was nominated by my request to then Attorney General Hardy Myers to have a victim representative or victim advocate representative at the table, and that was the recommendation of then Attorney General Hardy Myers. And Carol's not here, I don't believe, but she was at the time. Carol was the head of the Department of Justice Crime Victims Rights Implementation Project. She holds another position now within the Department of Justice, but still in the Crime Victim Services Division. And she's an attorney. She interfaced with various crime victims advocates, and we made it clear to her that part of her job was to do so, that she wasn't there representing the Department of Justice but the victim community. And that was actually a conversation that I had with her before she agreed to have the seat at the table, and she was willing to do that, and my understanding is that that is exactly what she did.
She was extremely active. Very, very active in this process.
Madam Chair, for the record, I made a recommendation for a gentleman to be on the group. In fact, he was included, Fred Borngasser from Grants Pass, representing Columbia Care.
Good. Representative Huffman, and then we're going to move on.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. And I hope I don't hold the process up too long, but I think there's some necessary bit. I appreciate all of the work that you guys were doing. And I may not have all the facts, so correct me and forgive me if I'm wrong. I have a little bit of frustration that while the work group was meeting, potential sightings for placement of homes was continuing without having the benefit of the information from your work group. And in my district, in Fossil, I lost the Wheeler County Sheriff and I lost the Wheeler County District Attorney because the process was not handled appropriately. There wasn't an upfront town hall meeting with a facilitator to do information and damage control, and the effort was, you know, this outside state entity came in and met with a few of the key leaders. And those leaders were perceived by the community as trying to bring this facility into the community. And, you know, I lost a couple of good people out there because the process was handled wrong. And
we're hoping not to replicate that. This is one of the purposes.
Yeah, and listening to the criteria for moving forward, and maybe it was in there and maybe you just called the individual by a different title or whatever, but I think it's critical that we have somebody that's experienced in information dissemination and marketing and going into a community first and having some town halls and fleshing out some of the questions that we know are going to be asked, mm-hmm. some of the concerns that we know are going to be there with this type of facility. And probably biggest of all, in an area of the state where we need jobs the most, I lost 15 really good paying jobs in one of my communities. And plus I got put in the middle of it too late, and I didn't want to lose my job either, so I was really trying to walk on eggshells. But by that point it was too late. There was too much wrong information out, and I would just, if you've got that person in place in that list and they were called something else, that's awesome.
Well, let's do the rest of the panels, and maybe we can address
really
some of your issues.
Thank you.
Okay.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, I'm Benton County Commissioner Jay Dixon. I represented the Association of Oregon Counties on this work group. By way of background, I also chair the AOC Public Safety Committee. I'm a member of the Oregon Community Corrections Commission, and I chair the Oregon Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee. I think we can boil this down to two words, and I think some of you have touched on it. What's really necessary to resolve these issues is more communication and better education. Even though I've spent more years than I want to talk about associated with the criminal justice system, this was a fascinating process for me because I learned so much about the mentally ill who have committed crimes, and the people who come under the jurisdiction of the PSRB. And we need to find ways to share that information with the public and to share that information with crime victims and others. So many of the recommendations that you've heard about deal with education and deal with communication. And the end result of a year's worth of work, or almost a year's worth of work of this work group for me, was that we can solve the problem if we do those things.
Thank you so much, and thank you for all the hours, the many hours that you put in this process. Your presence there was very enlightening and welcome. Ashley, are you next? It's always good to see you.
Yes, hello. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Ashley Brenton, and for those of you who may not know me, I am a former Oregon State Hospital patient and client of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, known as the PSRB, and I was placed under the jurisdiction of the PSRB for crimes of robbery in the first degree, Class A felony, assault in the second degree, Class B felony, assault in the third degree, Class C felony, and felony for attempting to elude a police officer, Class C felony, and this occurred on June 10th of 2000, and it was my first experience being in this situation. I had no criminal history prior to having my psychotic episode, and I was driving my car, and I was in downtown Portland, and I was thinking that that people were after me to kill me, and I had no idea that I had a mental illness. I was 44 years old at the time, and I actually tried calling the police department, and the conversation that I was hearing on the other end of the phone wasn't, it sounded just, I couldn't understand what they were saying. It just sounded like a bunch of garbly stuff, I don't know. But I did try getting help, and I called the fire department. They came to my apartment a few days before my car accident. But needless to say, time went on, my delusions and hallucinations were getting worse, and there was no one I could talk to because, I didn't realize I had a mental illness, and I had had a broken neck as a result of domestic violence 3 years prior. So when I was telling people that my ex-husband was after me to kill me, they all believed me, and my daughter believed me, and she believed that I had been followed by other people, and so I stopped at a gas station at 39th and Division for $10 of gas, and I had the money in my hand to pay for the gas, but when the gas station attendant reached in my car for the payment, I put my foot on the accelerator and I took off, and his arm got stuck in the window of my car, and I couldn't understand why this man was holding onto my car, and I tried sideswiping him with oncoming traffic, trying to get him off my car. At the same time, I was trying to obey the speed limit, which was 35 miles an hour. So, unfortunately, he jumped off and he got hurt. And the police, and I didn't stop to help him, by the way. I kept driving. And I was going through red lights as I was trying to keep the speed limit and trying to obey the law. I was going through red lights, trying to escape these police cars that were coming after me because I did not believe they were the police. I thought they were bad men that rented police cars and police uniforms, and I thought that I just had all kinds of terrifying delusions. And to make a long story short, the police pitted my car to get me to stop, and they had me at gunpoint. All these policemen had me at gunpoint, and they told me to get down on the ground, and I said, no, I'm not getting down. I know you're not the police. I wouldn't cooperate with them. I thought they were going to kill me, and they handcuffed me and took me to jail, and I still thought that I had been kidnapped by these bad men and didn't believe that I had committed a crime. So I was placed in jail in a special cell for people that don't cooperate, and I was eventually taken to court, and then taken to the Oregon State Hospital for an evaluation, and I didn't want to go back to the hospital because I didn't think it was really a hospital. I was just out of my mind. I just was really sick. And I refused medication while I was in jail. So I was in jail for about 3 months, unmedicated, hallucinating, seeing rats. I thought they were going to put in my cell 100 white rats and just all kinds of terrifying delusions. But I want you to know, people get better. I was able to get medication while I was at the Oregon State Hospital and therapy, and realized that I have a mental illness. I have schizophrenia. And so I know how important it is to take care of myself. And while I was in the Oregon State Hospital, I met many people like me that had committed horrible crimes. I was in Ward 50J, which is the most serious ward for the most serious offenders. And I met and roomed with several women that had committed terrible crimes and felt terribly guilty, and but they were going through the process trying to get better as well. And so I was placed under the jurisdiction of the PSRB, the Psychiatric Security Review Board, for 10 years, and I was released, and I was released early because I showed with a preponderance of evidence that I was not a danger to myself or others, and I'm now enrolled at school at PSU, Portland State University. I'm a junior, and I'm currently in a class called Leadership for Change, and thank you so much for listening to me.
Thank you, Ashley. We're so happy for you.
Thank you so much.
So, yes, good to see you again.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kent Barker. I'm the Chief of Police at Tualatin Police Department, and I'm currently the President of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. So I was on this committee as a representative for the Chiefs Association. And as police officers, we want to be prepared for anything. And one of the things is, as these houses were being cited, we weren't prepared for it. And so we had our reaction to it. But this committee helped us come to the table and meet with different people and helped us be educated better ourselves, because there were so many things that I learned sitting at the table. I mean, when I first started, I mean, I'll be honest, I was skeptical about the process with all the different people there. But as we met on a monthly basis, the more we were educated, the more understanding I had of how this process worked. And I could, being the last person to speak, it's easier for me just to say ditto to everything that was summarized here. But we did. We all came with different agendas. I mean, there were definitely different perspectives and opinions at the table. But we reached a compromise. I mean, we agreed that this is a great start, and if we can follow these recommendations that we've made, we're so much better off than where we were a year ago. And so I just want to say thank you for allowing me to be on this committee, and please take heed to the recommendations that our committee made. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Kent. Thank you for all the hours that you spent, and all. I think you came to every meeting also, didn't you?
I think I missed one or two, but I tried to be at all of them.
I know you were, and I almost didn't recognize you. I was going to make a joke about
about my foot.
His wife kicked him.
Well, he's got a different uniform. Good to see you. Thank you. Any quick questions of this panel before we move on? Thank you all for your work on this.
Yes. Can I add one thing?
Of course.
There was a question earlier about the statutory changes. And I think, having been a prosecutor for, I guess, 19 years and a judge for 18, and having spent really my whole professional life in and around criminal justice, and I used to do When I was a prosecutor, I basically took on most of the mental health cases that used to be prosecuted by the DA's office for a long period of time. I think that looking historically at Oregon's current, the development of Oregon's current approach to mental health defenses, there is really very wide agreement by prosecutors and defense attorneys and people in the mental health system that the system that we have as a way to handle that problem, similar to Ashley's, is a sensible, humane way to do it. And I think that is sort of the backdrop behind which there isn't really a lot of reason or discussion about changing the system, you know, whole changes of the system, which helps explain why there really aren't big needs for statutory changes here. And a lot of the things that we're talking about really in this are the siting of these facilities. So it does relate to more administrative changes and then practical changes that have to occur to make this process work so that people understand it, can accept it, and do at the community level, which we did sort of at the committee level, of having people begin to understand everybody's needs and the reality that we have to deal with this problem in some fashion, and there has to be an interface between the communities and this population. And so I think that's how we get to the point where there really aren't statutory changes needed.
Right. I'm always glad to see that when we don't have to pass more legislation, that then sometimes we have to go back because of unintended consequences and change again. So thank you, Judge. Thank you all again so much.
Thank you.
So our next panel is Mary Claire Buckley, Richard Harris, Vicki Logan. Go ahead, Mary Claire.
Morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Claire Buckley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. And I would like to start at the outset, on behalf of the board, whose chair is present with us today, to thank the governor and his staff, Judge Larson, and all the members of the work group for the time and effort they put into this project. The board appreciates their willingness to come together from various positions and differing perspectives to learn about the PSRB in general, as well as its system of community placement in particular, as well as the legal framework within which it operates. Their exploration of all the issues that are involved in this complex siting process and the ultimate issuance of these recommendations today should have a long-lasting impact not only on the board and its ability to return persons to the community whom it is determined can be safely managed there, but also the future of Oregon's mental health system, which by necessity is moving to a more community-based system of care. The work group's suggestions have shaped how we do business already. Their focus on more education and community involvement from the outset, I believe, is the only way we will be able to overcome the barriers we currently face in siting residential treatment facilities for persons with mental disabilities, particularly those under the Psychiatric Security Review Board. The board is pleased with the outcome of this work group and the fact that consensus was achieved on all of these recommendations, because clearly system change and its implementation is better served when there is consensus. The positive tone of the report, I think, reflects the acknowledgement of the need for such community development, but also a recognition that the current process for doing so could certainly be strengthened. The board welcomes the opportunity to engage our partners in system improvement, particularly with Addictions and Mental Health Division. Because as you may recall, when I did my PSRB 101 presentation a couple of weeks ago before this committee, I noted that when the board was created, the legislature designed it in such a way that the board was responsible for conducting hearings to determine our client's appropriate placement and monitoring those on conditional release whom the board determined could be returned to communities. But it put the responsibility for the development of and the payment for treatment services that the board requires for these individuals in the hands of DHS. Thus, Addictions and Mental Health Division and the board are inextricably entwined, at times much to the chagrin of some, I assume, but I think that fact was reflected in the information presented to the work group as well as its findings, which you will find many of which require joint action. The board now enjoys a strong and positive relationship with AMH, which is critical for the success of the board and this process. In fact, there are weeks when I spend more time with Richard's staff than I do with my own, and I think I spend enough time at on the third floor of the DHS building that I'm afraid they're going to start charging me rent. That is why there will be no problem with one of the recommendations that Judge Larson noted on page 17 that encourages the PSRB and DHS to formalize a working relationship because I believe that is already in effect and the only thing missing is the written document. Further, as a result of this partnership, the board and AMH have already initiated or expanded on a number of these proposals without waiting for this final report. As soon as some of these ideas were raised at the meetings, we moved on them because we saw the value that they offered in improving the system and thus our ability to ultimately serve this population, which both agencies are charged to do. So at this point, I'm going to briefly highlight some of the steps that the board has taken or enhanced, and then Rich is going to do the same for what AMH has done. You know, in my review of this report, you'll note also that there are seven major categories with a number of recommendations in each. But as Mr. Dixon indicated, I, too, extracted two major themes from this report, the need for more education and outreach. I think in each one of these categories you can see those two themes. With regards to outreach, the board is reaching out to the public and other stakeholders to provide information that obviously is critically needed to dispel the fears about our population, which are causing the difficulties we're having today in siting. We are participating in trainings of all sorts, from neighborhood meetings to CIT trainings, CLEs that are put on by the bar, local...
You've got to say what those are.
Oh, I'm sorry. CIT is the crisis intervention training that police officers undergo that I am invited to present at. Continuing legal education that meetings that are done by the bar and other legal entities, associations, both of the defense attorneys and the district attorneys, and numerous other opportunities that we seize to educate individuals and members of the public. In addition, in terms of educational efforts, we have updated what I have always affectionately called the our PSRB propaganda packet, which is a packet of information that we have about many of the things that Judge Larson talked about, a history and functioning of the board, its success rate, so that people will be able to understand what the board does, because I think clearly from the work of the committee, as you've heard, there is a lot of ignorance or misunderstanding about how the board operates. We've prepared a fact sheet on the PSRB that we hand out at any opportunity.
Mary Claire, do we have any of those materials?
I believe they've been provided to your committee at the last at our
right.
PSRB.
Right.
And,
okay.
But if you want more, I'll be happy to. We've been involved with AMH in providing data so that the location of all these individuals can be identified so that a strategic plan can come up because clearly the location of these sites has been an issue and we'll be working on that. And the two issues that are most pertinent to the board or solely to the board I wanted to touch on was, number one, the victims' rights, which Representative Maurer raised. I want to make it clear that the board has always notified those individuals who desire notification of PSRB hearings and encourage their participation and even accommodate their schedule. We have continued matters hearings if they couldn't attend and set dates to accommodate their attendance. We also notify individuals if an individual is revoked or they're abscond for supervision, which was one of the issues raised. However, at this point, our system is one of notification by mail, which obviously takes a couple of days for the recipient to receive. And so we have already pursued one of the recommendations, which is to contact the VINE system, which is, I believe, the Victim Information Notification Link, which is an online resource that allows victims to search or to be notified immediately, much more immediately. And so we've had those conversations, and I'm now waiting for basically a cost estimate as to what it would take for the board to avail itself of that mechanism for immediate contact to the victims. And finally, the notification issue with regards to both law enforcement and an expansion of that, as Mr. O'Leary mentioned, that was one of the first things that was raised even before this committee, was formed. And the board immediately responded to that. It's one of those things. The statute initially directed the board to notify the district attorney of the committing county, the victim, and the judge of the committing who handled the case. And we have done that since the board's inception. Prior to this time, law enforcement or no one had ever raised that issue. And as soon as it was raised, it made perfect sense to the board, although, once again, my hesitation is only with continuing to take on added work without resources, but we saw that this was so important that we immediately changed our protocol and as of last February 1st, began to notify both the receiving sheriff and police chief in the jurisdiction where the individual is released of their address, the crime for which they're placed under the board, and their case manager's name so that they can contact them and myself if they have any concerns. So that's in place. You'll note in the recommendations that there is a recommendation to expand this to district attorneys in the receiving counties. And, we're hopeful that if, resources are provided, that we can continue to expand that. So those are the things that we've already, started on that are contained in this report. There obviously are things that remain to be done, as noted by Judge Larson and in the executive summary as well. Some of these will require additional resources, and I know that's a difficult thing to say in this environment, but in order to implement some of these, because they are not included in the governor's recommended budget at this time, despite the board's willingness, its staffing is inadequate to take on much additional workload that's required of, by some of these. But if it had the support, the board would love to have a victim liaison to do more outreach to victims, to implement this VINE system and to take responsibility for in putting the information, to be more proactive in seeking the victim's attendance or participation in our hearings, to expand the notification, as I mentioned, and to establish the unified database that was referred to as well. So those things remain on the radar, and as I said, the board welcomes any opportunity to improve as long as some of those resources could be made available. In closing, I would just note that the board is proud of its record in protecting public safety for the last 30 years. However, it recognizes that its system, like any other, can always be improved. New issues are raised, the environment in which we operate has changed, and the board must respond, and it knows that. The board realizes that it requires the support and confidence of the public, including local elected officials, law enforcement personnel, neighbors, and the public in general, if it is to continue to be successful. So we look forward to implementing these recommendations of the work group and thank this committee for the opportunity to discuss it this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary Claire. Any quick questions of...
Whose map is this? Whose map?
Richard. Okay. He'll talk about it.
Okay. Any quick questions? Mary Claire, thanks for all the work that you have done through this. And also, there is a siding of a placement in my neighborhood. Mary Claire has been very active in there and very responsive. And I appreciate that. Thank you. Richard.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Richard Harris. I'm the Assistant Director of at DHS for Addictions and Mental Health Services. I'm going to be working from this document, which I believe that everyone should have a copy of. But before I go there, I just wanted to make a few comments about the responsibilities of Addictions and Mental Health Division in this system of mental health care for people that are under jurisdiction of the PSRB. It's the AMH responsibility to provide mental health care to mentally ill both at the state hospital and in the community. And as we've talked about before, there's a whole system of services that are provided, an array of services, and which includes services to people that are under the jurisdiction of PSRB. This entails really appropriate levels of care and supervision in these community facilities once people have left the state hospital. So our responsibilities are in siting the facilities, in operating the facilities, in licensing the facilities. And in general, as you know, the mental health services are provided in a partnership with counties. In the case of many of these facilities, those facilities are under contract with the county with funds that flow through AMH. But in the case of some of the facilities also, they are directly contracted to nonprofit providers in the community that are under contract AMH. So it's working in a partnership with different kinds of organizations out there. But almost all of these facilities are operated by private nonprofit organizations that are licensed and supervised by the Addictions and Mental Health Division. And I just wanted to, since Representative Maurer brought this up already, there is a map in your packet which shows where all of these mental health facilities are in the state of Oregon. And we'll go back to this map in a few minutes. So when the long before the work of the siting work group was completed, there were many items in that were being considered and issues that told us that we needed to pay attention because there were difficulties in the communities, as cited by Representative Huffman, how very serious some of the efforts had gone the wrong direction, and there were considerable problems. And there was a recognition that somehow or another we needed to move on that. We didn't feel like we should wait for the finished product of the report. We should start looking at the siting process to make the necessary changes to be successful in siting these. However, the report is very thoroughly documented what most of those best practices should be, and I'd like to go through those, if I may, and I'll try to be as brief as I can, but again, working from this document. Community outreach is absolutely essential to successful siting of facilities that are treating not just mentally ill, but people with addictions, people who may be returning to the community from the prison system. There are a variety of populations of people who need facilities in the community. In fact, that's how they learn to deal with the issues that they're confronted with. And so it's not like keeping people either in state-run institutions, people need to be returned to the community. And how we do that is critical. When I was the executive director at Central City Concern, I cited probably someplace in the neighborhood of 20 different facilities in and around the Portland area and some even in Clackamas County. And realizing that there is a method that needs to be followed if you're going to successfully site facilities where people may be stigmatized and seen as a problem to the community. And we've made efforts recently to change and improve those siting processes, including we at AMH brought over Bob Repine and Sharon Anderson, who were working in the state hospital the new state hospital facilities to help us out with organizing the efforts to site facilities in the community and do it in an organized fashion, which does mean working with local leaders in the community in a proactive way long before sites are selected. This includes both city, county, and law enforcement individuals. When sites are being considered, needs to be an effort made with neighbors, neighborhood associations, and other organizations in the community to make sure that what needs to be sited is going to be successfully sited in its place. But you must talk seriously with the local community. And some of those things weren't being done before.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. Richard, thank you for being proactive before the committee finished the recommendation. Since the Wheeler County situation, have we had successes around the state with the new model that you're talking about?
Yes, we have. And at some point, if you would like to, I can ask Bob to come up here and in more detail explain those. But both in Washington County and in Representative Tomei's district, we've moved further down the line with those projects and overcome considerable resistance simply by listening to people and providing the right kind of information and working through these issues. So, yes. But it takes more than just following the siting issues. There are many other suggestions that were made in here that were very specific about how to proceed with outreach to law enforcement, both in siting and in notice of individuals who may be coming to the community. And those are two separate issues, and they're, in ways, the notice of people coming to the community are governed by a number of statutes and other rights that people have. So Mickey may touch on some of these in her testimony. Also, when a facility is in operation, since we have responsibility for its operation, we need to be certain that it's operating with the correct standards, and we are currently now reviewing our administrative rules for facilities like this as part of a larger review in creating a more sensible administrative rule in how AMH manages all of its programs. But we are focusing particularly on the OARs as they pertain to the operations of the facilities in the community. The question has come up in a recommendation about distribution of facilities, and if we could just look at this map for a minute. As you can see by this map, there are different kinds of facilities, including adult foster homes, residential treatment homes, residential treatment facilities, and secure residential treatment facilities.
Madam Chair. Thank you. Richard, just to give us, maybe a little perspective, from Ashley's testimony, which category would Ashley have fit in here so I can kind of have a gauge?
You know, that wouldn't be something I could really talk about, but I'm sure we can find out. And she could probably even tell us what facility she was in. But we're given guidance by the PSRB so that when somebody is sent from the PSRB, it specified what type of facility they need to be in. But people change, and that's what we would hope they are changing, so that they may be in a secure residential facility and then later in a residential facility. And what's important here is making sure that people can be safe, the community can be safe, and they get the appropriate level of care where they're at. So eventually we want to return people to the community unsupervised, and so there's an effort to make sure the right level of care is provided to those individuals. So you can see by the map there's a distribution. That this distribution is not driven by some long-seeking plan about this. This distribution is, by and large, been built up over the years in terms of where residential treatment facilities are needed and what communities are desirous of having these facilities in their community. Going forward into the future, we understood that if you have a different distribution formula, we'd be glad to work with PSRB and the recommendations in this to get an equitable distribution. But right now, I don't believe that's defined in any level of detail. But you can see this map provides a fairly wide scattering of facilities around the state.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Maurer.
Thanks. And this distribution, to me, is somewhat important. That this is by accident, essentially. But they're going to work on it's GIS mapping, and I'm assuming there's some rationale to this methodology. Is it based on population density, or?
Well, my understanding of the current system is that it evolved over time, and it was based on maybe some of it is accidental, and part of it may be okay. Intentional. The GIS mapping effort, because one of the things we discovered is that there's this map, then there are maps, if you drew them correctly, that have other facilities on them that are serving people with other disabilities and other issues, and you really need to see what those other facilities are, because the density of facilities in a particular community, they may not be all AMH facilities, they could be a number of other facilities, and one of the things that's happened to us is we discover that communities get quite concerned if there's a concentration of disabled individuals or people with mental illness or people with other kinds of problems. So we have to locate where everything is. Now, that's a tough job, but that's where we're going next.
Representative, you have a follow-up question?
Just a follow-up. To include corrections?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So we're looking for a plan to go forward with, is what I'm saying.
Great.
Okay. Obviously, there are following under education, many things that we've started doing already that have been referred to in terms of putting together information in ways that can be readily understood in the community and really targeted to education, to community leaders, law enforcement, but it's neighborhoods and the public in general, and we're working on those things now. A special effort we are making is to work with NAMI to make sure that their involvement is essential in communities, and that we and they work together on how we talk about the issues around mental illness. Mental illnesses and addictions are things that are highly stigmatized in our communities, and we want to make sure that what we're doing is not stigmatizing people, but helping the community understand what their needs are. The licensing requirements, as I reiterated, or what I'd like to reiterate, is that we're working on changing some of those. This report was very instructive in terms of what are the things that we need to be looking at, particularly with the secure facilities. The secure facilities are the newest of the facilities, and we realize there are licensing expectations that have not been clearly delineated, and we're working on those now. I think things going forward is that we obviously have some recommendations or changes we need to make here that will have a fiscal impact, and we're trying to sort those out right now in terms of how we would solve some of those financial issues, and mostly around the facilities themselves. We want to make sure that they're cost efficient and actually buildable, and they're fitting the licensure requirements. I would say that, in summary, that we have really three main goals at AMH, and that is that there's a sufficiency of programs, facilities, and housing to meet the mental health needs of those under PSRB jurisdiction. And that means the range of activities, not just one type of facility, but what would meet the total need. That we have to focus on managing that system in the most cost-effective manner that we can, because these are not inexpensive facilities in the community. And we need to make sure that there's an array of services that will help people move from PSRB into the community as independent individuals in a safe and appropriate manner.
Great. Thank you so much, Richard. Any quick questions?
Just quickly, because Richard seems to be kind of one of the point people on this, I would recommend when going into a community to, because I didn't really see them on the list, involve chamber and economic development key people, because in rural communities especially, those are typically the people that have been involved in siting and placing Oregon veterans homes, schools, and others into to neighborhoods that might be kind of controversial, and they know the community and they know how to step around the mines that might be in a specific community. More, no offense, but more so than maybe the law enforcement people or the DAs.
Interesting idea. Thank you. Representative Maurer.
Madam Chair, I have to ask this question, and it's for Richard. You said in developing this map to include the various facilities that you discussed, to include corrections, you hinted, actually you said it, you said it's a difficult task. And I'm wondering, does the state not know where its facilities are? Is that, because I took away from that, how can this be difficult?
Well, the state's not the only group that are siting facilities. Both counties also site facilities for other purposes. So I think it's more difficult than we anticipate it would be in the future, so, or in the actual functioning. One of the more active individuals in the Milwaukee area who was very active in opposition to siting one of the facilities actually sent me a map that had numerous facilities on it, and when we started comparing with what we knew, we understood immediately that there were many other facilities that the Department of Corrections, the county, and everybody else knew where they were. We didn't know where they were. So that's why now what we're doing is researching where those facilities are, who they're serving, what their size is, what their location is, and the GIS mapping is about the best way to go about doing this. It just, it's taking more work than we thought it would.
One follow-up. An example of something that you wouldn't necessarily know about might be an Oxford House.
We'd know all the Oxford houses.
Okay. I'm trying to think of I'm really not trying to pick on you, because I mean, I really appreciate your work. It just seems really strange to me that we don't know where things are, or that we don't have a handle on what's out there.
For instance, as an example, the federal halfway houses for people in the federal judiciary system, which we don't generally have any, is one example. Foster placements, so we have to, you know, figure out where the SPD foster homes are, which is not in the AMH database, but is in the SPD database. So all I'm saying is that that information exists, it's just in different places.
It is hard. I tried to do the same thing. It's very hard.
We will do it, however.
Just a quick question for Richard, too, since he's in the hot seat. On the victims' rights piece, it said that PSRB will continue notifying victims by mail when the perpetrator absconds. Is there any consideration of maybe a phone call or something quicker than mail?
I think that what we have to review is the whole area about how what AMH's responsibilities are in this issue about how people leave the facilities, abscond or go without notice. And that was not one of the things that was written into the administrative rules that has to be added, what the notification process is, both to police and to the community in large and to victims. So that's an area that we have to develop in our rules.
Okay. Very clear. Do you want to respond to that?
Just briefly, Madam Chair, Representative Boone, that has been the, historically in the purview of the board. It's our responsibility statutorily to keep victims notified, and that's why those reports come from them. If somebody leaves a facility, they would obviously be in violation of their conditional release, so that call goes to the board first. We issue the revocation order, and then we would do the mail notification, and that's why we're looking into Vine, because if we were able to participate in this online service, my understanding is that we would then call Vine, and Vine would then make that immediate call, either by a computer or a phone call. I guess they have...
sort of like a reverse 911.
Yes. Yep.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Mickey, thank you for coming today and being involved in this process so very competently.
Thank you, Chair Tomei, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is Mickey Logan. I'm a senior assistant attorney general at the Oregon Department of Justice. I actually was not a member of the group that issued this report that's before you. I was asked late last spring by Aaron Kelly Thiel and Joe O'Leary. They tapped someone at my office, me, to be a neutral person who's familiar with underlying laws. The Oregon Department of Justice is just basically a way to inform folks about what the laws are that apply, but not take a policy position. So I'm not in front of you because I have any recommendations or because I have any policies that I would speak about. But to give you a very brief, 1 or 2 minutes, overview of the presentation I gave last summer to the work group regarding the state and federal laws that they needed to know about and that people need to be educated about in order to not inadvertently, to put it bluntly, walk into a lawsuit. Because being attorney for the state of Oregon, we want everyone to follow the laws. And as you've heard the other witnesses testify this morning, there are a lot of laws, and they're good laws, that are already in place in Oregon and federal that affect all of these issues. The primary laws, the two primary laws that I was asked to speak about are the federal housing laws and state housing laws and Americans with Disabilities Act. And the message that I was conveyed to the committee last summer and that I can succinctly tell you right now is that people who are found guilty except for insanity, by the very nature of the way those statutes are written and those findings are made, are automatically protected by the Americans with Disabilities Act and the federal housing laws. And also because of those protections, any determination about any of the individuals who might be under the PSRB jurisdiction would have to be made on a case-by-case basis. So, for example, this alludes to what Mr. Harris was talking about, which is that any individual would presumably start out in the hospital because they need the highest level of care, hospital care, because they're that ill. And as they recover in their illness, they would go to where they as an individual need to be in a, from what the Americans with Disabilities Act requires to be the least intrusive, least restrictive setting. So that is why there is this... I'll use the word push, to get folks out of the hospital setting, which is, I think we'd all agree, the most restrictive setting, to a less restrictive setting. And then the map indicates a variety of different settings a person might be in. But it's the Americans with Disabilities Act that that is the law behind that push, that there have been many lawsuits around the country, notably New Jersey and Michigan. And then there's the Olmstead case that went to the United States Supreme Court in 1999 that made it very clear to the people like myself who work in this world that if communities and any public entity isn't working towards moving people who are ill into the least restrictive setting that they can successfully and safely live in, then they will be opening themselves up to the possibility of lawsuits.
Why don't you finish, Mickey, and then we'll take questions if there are.
Well, that's basically it. That's what I told the committee about, Americans with Disability Act, federal housing law. Oregon has its state counterparts to those laws that are consistent with them, and I don't have anything to add except There's the law.
And what Mickey is saying is extremely important. I want to make sure that everybody in the committee understands what she is saying. Representative Huffman.
It will. And, Mickey, correct me if I'm wrong, but basically, just to kind of throw it out on the table, I appreciate the work that that Richard and his crew are doing in the community outreach and stuff. But sincerely, the bottom line is they wouldn't have to. You can cite one of these homes anywhere you want by federal law. I've had dealings with that myself, and it stung. But I mean, that's the truth of the law. Am I correct in that, Mickey? You could go into a community and buy a piece of property and cite it there, and the community and residents really wouldn't have anything to say about it.
Well, Chair and members of the committee, I don't want to pretend to be advocating for that, but the fact of the matter is the law is very clear. And in fact, I might go so far as to say there have been states where when the states have tried to be communicative, and they have run into lawsuits. We are very fortunate in Oregon that the advocates, the mental health advocates community, wants to work with Oregon and recognizes that it is a good practice and can be a good practice. But there's actually a Michigan case that says doing that, in fact, gives people ammunition who want to keep folks out of their neighborhood. And so you shouldn't do that. And so it was a decision made by a policy decision made by the group and by the DHS and PSRB and all of the stakeholders, and I don't disagree with that. I don't have an opinion about that. It's just that you're right. They didn't have to go that way. I certainly wouldn't recommend against going that way.
No, like I say, I appreciate the softer approach that we're taking. The reality of it is, I know where federal court is downtown Portland. Just leave it at that.
Thank you, Representative.
And I was innocent, by the way. I was not discriminated.
I've only been in there to be on a jury myself.
Thank you.
Just a comment, because that's really the crux, I think, of this issue. Because if the communities could stop it, in many cases they would. They would stop it. But the law is very, I mean, there's a very bright line here. And I think there's also, a social responsibility. As leaders, we need to step up and say our communities need to play their part in this if we're going to have community-based services. And you know, that's why I want to know where these facilities are, all of them, so that I know that my district is pulling its own weight. Because I want to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. And in fact, in the end, I think my district is going to show itself to be a part of the solution. So, I mean, that's why those numbers are important, and so that you can work with advocates, because it's important to those facilities that these people are accepted. Because if you cram it down someone's throat, I don't care what the law is, you're feeding the stigma. And that's what we need to stop.
Thank you, Representative Maurer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just echo that, and that was the point I was going to make earlier. I would have really been appreciative as being the district rep for Fossil to have been brought into the process ahead of the curve. It just so happens with my background, I think I could have run a lot of interference, which maybe some representatives don't have that particular background. In my situation, I think I could have really helped. But like Representative Maurer said, you know, it's nice for us to know what's going on in our district.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Huffman. Any other comments? Representative Cowan.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Just to respond to those comments, I think that you make a very good point that we can be liaisons in our community when the need is there. I think it's also incumbent upon us then to help educate the rest of our body. If we ask folks to reach out to their local representation, then we need to help the rest of our counterparts understand what the law is, what the challenges are that we're trying to address, not related to the placement of the sorts of facilities that you're talking about, but some of those other array of facilities that are in our communities. One of the homes in my neighborhood sold recently and was purchased by providers for a group home for the disabled. And by pure happenstance, I got an email one day that said, "I just saw you pulling out of your driveway. I think you are our new neighbor." And that chance notice by the folks that were doing it resulted in very easily our pulling together a neighborhood group and a tour of the new home and an opportunity for everyone to get their questions answered. And I think we were able to forestall a lot of the neighborhood concerns that were absolutely there for the siting of any sort of a group facility. But it is also important that we help others in our body understand what the roles are if we're going to ask individuals to reach out to us.
Excellent point. Any further?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I would offer myself if, as everybody's working on this, and you do go into a district and you notify the representative of that district or the senator or whatever, I'd be happy to, for you to say, contact Representative Huffman if you would like some pointers on maybe the best way to approach this with your constituents. I'd be happy to visit with members about that.
Great. I can't imagine that's going to be, that we will also be in the list of notification. We are expecting an awfully lot of these people without giving them a lot of extra funds. Right. So that's a great point, but I guess I don't want to put on the responsibility on them that they've got to notify the legislators when facility will be coming in. And my guess is that probably your neighborhoods will alert you when that's coming in.
But Madam Chair, that oftentimes it's too late, and that's my point. So.
Any further? Thank you all so much. You've done excellent work.
Thank you.
Okay. I guess I would like for people to stand up who had been involved in these meetings. Sometimes there were dozens of people at these meetings, and some people were around the table. So at least stand up so that this committee can see who you were involved. Thank you so much. I'm going to ask you just to introduce yourself. Stand up. Keep standing. Okay, Barry, introduce yourself just quickly and let me know what your role is.
My name is Barry Cast, and I'm the public member of the PSRB.
Thank you.
Kent Barker with the Chiefs Association.
Again, thank you. And
Ashley?
Ashley
Brenton, Mental Health Consumer.
Thank you, Ashley.
Scott Winkles with the League of Oregon Cities.
And Len Ray, Administrator for Adult Mental Health Services with Addictions and Mental Health.
Thank you.
Gina Neckel with the Counties.
And Bob Jude, Disability Rights Oregon.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you all for being involved in this process, which was at times a very arduous process.
We had one more.
I'm sorry.
Were you trying to stand?
Sure, stand up. Stand, dear. Is that?
I'm not sure who Joe was referring to, but he was.
I was
encouraging.
Pointing out Kevin Neely, our chair from the Disability Association. He was at one meeting, and I'll stand up for him.
Hi, Kevin.
I knew there were signals out there. I just couldn't interpret them.
Okay. Again, thank you all for being involved and helping us come up with a very good product here. With that, unless there's somebody else I should hear or something else I should do.
I haven't signed up to testify.
We're going to hear a bill, and then you can testify for that. This was just a public information. Okay, we'll close the informational meeting on the Psychiatric Review Board Siting Workshop and open up the public hearing on House Bill 2052. Let's see, why don't you
read? You want me to?
Yes, you tell us briefly what it is, and then we'll have Representative Olson come down and testify.
This amends Oregon statutes to include requiring public agencies to inform the local Public Safety Coordinating Council of that agency's intent to site residences for individuals under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board in that council's locality. It amends the duties of the Public Safety Coordinating Council to include appointment of a subcommittee for reviewing agency proposals.
Thank you, Keeley. Representative Olson. Well, this was a committee bill, but one that Representative Olson has put much time and energy into.
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Andy Olson. I'm state representative out of the Albany area. And 2052 is actually a result of a number of folks that were involved or directly involved with the task force that you had a chance to listen to this morning already. And some of the questions that were asked, Representative Huffman as well as Maurer, you both asked some interesting questions that caused 2052 to come to surface. Because let's face it, just as what was mentioned earlier about the federal law driving this, you know, the perception is, yes, could it be shoved right down your throat in the communities? Yes, it could. But there was an avenue that I felt that we could pursue that could actually soften that. The idea behind 2052 is it's basically three simple little parts. The first thing is that...
Excuse me. Somebody has their cell phone or BlackBerry on or Blueberry or Raspberry. It isn't enough just to put them on mute. You have to turn them completely off or it does affect the sound system. Thank you.
Thank you. Wow. Okay. Let's see if I can go backwards here now. All right. Anyways, three different things. The first thing that we wanted to do, and it's important, is to maintain the integrity of PSRB. And the second thing that we really wanted to do with the whole thing is to bring transparency to the whole process of what was happening, because you had Milwaukee, as you know, Madam Chair, you're aware of what's happening, as well as over in Cornelius, down in my area in Albany, and a number of other places, too, that had some serious issues dealing with placement of a secured home in their residential areas. And then the last one, it's probably the most important of the three, and Representative Huffman, that gets to your point, is providing a voice to the community. And that's where then 2052 comes into the picture. If you've done a little bit of homework and you've taken a look at what the statute of ORS 169-690 talks about, it talks about the idea of Citizens Advisory Committee, but it doesn't apply to PSRB. So from that groundwork on that statute, we developed this to a point where what we would do is use your public safety local, or your safety public coordinating PSEPs, or lip syncs, local public safety coordinating council. There we go. Thank you. And there's two counties in the state that do not have those, and the amendments itself that we have, the dash ones, deal with that. But to go through the bill itself, we use that in identifying a little subgroup that would be involving the district attorney of that county, the chief of police or the sheriff of that county, respectively, whichever was in control of the jurisdiction of the placement of the siding or the intentional location, an advocacy group for mental health individuals, then also the director of the county for mental health as well. So you would bring in this group when the idea and the concept was to place a home in a neighborhood or in a community and have them then review what would be the best place for a siting, a placement. 60 days to get back to PSRB themselves to let them know what's going on. And that's how simple it is. And I have a number of folks here that can really share that have done an extreme amount of work with me over this whole thing as well.
Senator, do you have your BlackBerry on?
It was him all the time.
Madam Chair,
a question of the representative. Is it too late to add in community representatives from, like, the Chamber, Economic Development, or this marketing group, which I personally think are an equal and integral part of the success, having been there many times in the past?
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, I appreciate you sharing that. There's one other portion that I forgot to add or mention that's also part of this. It's either your city manager or your county commissioner as well. thinking that there should be that connection there than what's happening as well for what you're suggesting.
And Representative, this just is, these are required groups. Certainly other people could be invited and involved. This is, just gives a starting group that the county commissioners, et cetera. My concern about that would be, in some counties, I can't imagine that my Chamber of Commerce would want to be involved. I can imagine that in your county that would be the case. But to require that, I think, would open up a can of worms that probably would be difficult to deal with. But
yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, I'm somewhat reluctant to want to go that direction. I think you want to keep the group here narrow and focused, but yet have a good feel for that voice of the community with placement.
Representative Maurer, do you have a follow-up?
Well, I'd like to treat him as a hostile witness at this point. No, I can understand the point, and communities probably do differ.
Maybe we
I guess I guess hopefully we could have the, hopefully the county commissioner, somebody would have the forward thinking to include them.
Right, Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And this is at the end of the first page and beginning of page two. It seems like the language is inconsistent, and actually the last lines 1 through 4 of page 2. For the purposes of this subparagraph, a residential treatment home or facility is secure if a resident's exit from the home facility on the grounds are restricted, etc. But it doesn't talk about a secure resident treatment facility. And is there language in an amendment to kind of clean that up? Or
yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Maurer, good eye. And there is, and that's the what you've just read is being removed in the amendment.
Thank you. Okay.
Yeah. You get a gold star. Any other questions? Thank you, Representative. Thanks for all the work you've done on this. And we have several people who are wanting to speak on this. We're going to try to go through them quickly. I'm going to call up three at once. How about Len Ray, Bob Joondef, and Megan Cahy? And then Scott, if he's still here, will be last. And Scott, I know you're here all the time, so if we don't hear you today, we may hear you at a future date if we run out of time, but maybe we won't. Okay. So, gentlemen. All right. Lynn, why don't you proceed?
Chair Tomei and representatives of the committee, my name is Len Ray, and I'm the administrator for Adult Mental Health Services for Addictions and Mental Health with the Department of Human Services. And today I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2052 with the proposed amendments. The Addictions and Mental Health Division is responsible for financing, licensing, and regulating residential care facilities that serve people with mental illness. These include facilities that serve people under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. In some cases, AMH is directly involved in the siting process, and in others, local providers are involved in that process. Regardless of who initiates the siting of a new facility, AMH has begun a process to better engage local communities in the siting process before a final facility is decided upon. This includes working with local elected officials, law enforcement, and leaders in the community. We appreciate Representative Olson bringing forward this bill and working with us to amend it. This legislation has highlighted an important local community resource that we believe will help decrease the local concerns regarding these facilities. Consulting with the local Public Safety Coordinating Council will be a valuable step in our new process. It is important to note that this is an advisory process. Federal and state laws do not allow local communities to discriminate against individuals in siting housing, and this includes people with a disabling mental illness. We would recommend one additional amendment to the bill. In 2007, the legislature mandated that advisory councils and work groups that impact people with mental illness include at least 20% consumers of mental health services. We respectfully request that the law specify a consumer of mental health services be included on the local public safety coordinating council. Thank you for the opportunity for me to testify.
Thank you, Len. Great, thank you. Any questions of this witness? Okay, thanks. Bob, thanks for being so involved also in the process through all the months that we met.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon. And I have been very involved with the siting work group and with the formulation of this bill. I think it's important to point out, and I'd like to thank members of the committee for recognizing that people with disabilities do have a right to live in their community when they do not pose a danger to other people, just like anybody else would, and that the laws that do protect people from discrimination don't protect people who are dangerous, who are overtly dangerous. So the people who come out from the PSRB are folks who have gone through a gauntlet of evaluation, treatment, and this involves not only having the doctors in the hospital determine that they're safe, but having the PSRB do so, being accepted by community mental health agencies, by housing providers, demonstrating that they are safe and they are recovering in the process of recovery from their mental illness. And so it's very important, I think, that we recognize that and that the state has been, and the PSRB have been extremely successful in their task to help people recover from their mental illnesses so that they can safely return to society. And those are the people that we're talking about. House Bill 2052 is an attempt to bring that message to communities. That's our perspective. This is a bill, in our estimation, that can be used well, and it could potentially be used poorly. And so on its face, from our perspective, it does not violate people's rights to work with communities to make sure that there's a proper understanding of this system and how it works and the safeguards that are in place, and that's all good. If it were used for the purposes of interfering with the placement of a facility, blocking the placement of a facility, in my estimation, it would then be violative of the law. So not as applied, if it were used for the purposes of delay or for interfering with creation of a housing opportunity for a person, then it would. So with that having been said, we are supportive of this bill. We really thank Representative Olson for all the work that he's done in making sure that it fits the criteria that are necessary to make it work. We share the concern about having individuals with mental illness on that committee because we feel that it's always important to hear from people who actually experience the mental illness and have gone through some of the challenges that are inherent in that experience. So with that, thank you.
Thank you, Bob. I think what Mr. Judeff is saying is so important, and I feel a little bit concerned. I think we understand the intent of this bill and the hearings that we heard today. My fear is that future legislatures might see this as a way of stopping rather than facilitating homes coming in, that if the community gets involved, that and if the community says, well, we're advising you not to allow homes with these folks in it, that it will have a different outlook. So I just want us to be thinking about that as we move this forward. Representative Maurer.
Madam Chair, I would suggest, and I absolutely agree with Bob on his point, but the way it's working now, you've had city councils and counties have stepped up to oppose it in violation of the law, and I think that absolutely the intent can be misconstrued,
right.
But the point is to try to create a process to avoid that
right.
mm-hmm. from mm-hmm. happening, and so you just have to be vigilant, and I don't think we're ever going to get over the, at least in my lifetime times two, get over this stigma issue, but you can work toward it.
Right.
You know, we change culture one death at a time.
Yes.
So.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And we're lucky to have people like Mr. June Deaf here who is looking out for the good of people who are disabled and have a hard time sometimes looking out for their own best interests. So thank you, Bob. Macon.
Hello. Madam Chair Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Megan Cahay. Thank you so much for allowing me to testify today on behalf of Mental Health America of Oregon, of which I'm the vice president. I wanted to first acknowledge the work group, Judge Larson, County Commissioner Dixon, the police chief, Mr. O'Leary, and others that worked so hard on these issues. Their intentions are obviously very thoughtful and in the right place. I wanted to say our organization is an advocacy organization, and we're strongly in favor of community integration and of having residential treatment facilities across our state and communities. We think this is very important. However, with this bill 2052, we believe that this bill will not help with siting of secure residential treatment facilities. We feel that this bill, as written, and its amendments perpetuates prejudice and discrimination towards persons with mental illness. Part of what the problem is has to do with, well, you've heard from Mr. Ray and Mr. June Deaf referring to needing people with mental illness on the subcommittee, the advisory subcommittee. There is a bill, Senate Bill 364, which does say that there needs to be 20% of persons that have used mental health services on work groups, task force, and committees having to do with mental illness. That is lacking in this bill. In one amendment, it does mention on page 3, line 4, that there be a representative or advocate for persons that have mental illness. So that's one amendment. And we agree, we support this amendment, but it doesn't go far enough. Part of the problem that we see with the siting of residential treatment facilities is that there is so much fear that people have around persons with mental illness. And we don't see that HB 2052 really does anything to reduce the fear and prejudice that people have. In fact, we think it could add to the fear that people have. And so we would really hope that there would be some way to find something out of the box to address the fear, but actually involving persons that have used mental health services in leadership positions and other persons, the advocates, is one way to step out of the box and help in terms of bringing these treatment facilities to our communities. So that's what I would like to propose. I thank you very much.
Thank you, Megan. Any quick questions of this witness? Thank you so much. Thank you all. Tom, are you still here? We're short on time, so if you could just... And you're also welcome, of course, to submit written testimony.
Good Madam Chair, members of the committee, in the interest of time, I'll abandon my prepared remarks. For the record, Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities, appearing in support of House Bill 2052. The League of Oregon Cities was also a participant in the work group, and we're very proud to do so. This is a piece of legislation that is very important to a number of our members, and as earlier testimony indicated, there is the potential that someone could attempt to use this bill for a purpose other than what was intended, but we participated in this process on behalf of the folks who are going to use this bill for good purposes. The Dash 1 amendments will also add a city representative to the LPSC work group. We feel that this does add value in two ways. First, when a resident finds out a facility is going in, their first contact is probably going to be to their city council, city government. If the response from the city council, from the city government, is that we didn't know anything about this, it doesn't help the situation. It doesn't quell any concerns. Secondly, is that we think that we can add value to this process and make a healthier, safer environment for both residents and consumers. For instance, the contractors might want to know what's your fire and medical response time from this facility. Are there natural hazards in the area? Are there problems in the neighborhood you're looking at that you should be aware of? These are things that I think are going to make, again, for a safer process for everybody. As to the concerns raised by earlier speakers in regards to the presence of a consumer on the LPSC subcommittee, the League has no objections, and I'm happy to work with those members, those stakeholders, to draft an amendment with the permission of the co-chairs. With that, I will conclude my testimony.
Any quick questions of this witness? Thank you so much, Scott.
Thank you.
So, Representative Anthony, I'll close the public hearing on this and open up a work session as soon as possible. And maybe you could put together, what do they call it when you put together the amendment into the bill?
And engrossed.
Can you maybe and Keeley work together with that so we can see what's taken out and what's added in, so we can see what we're working on as soon as possible. All right. With that, my gosh, we're ending on time. I close the public hearing on House Bill 2052 and close the House Committee on Human Services. Thank you all very much. Thank you all for coming Monday morning.